This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Gold Rock Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice. This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, and my name is Darren Rockman, and I'm a partner at Gold Rock, the more than 20-year-old multifamily office servicing high net worth families in Israel and around the world. And today on the podcast, I am really, really pleased and excited to have Jason Greenblatt. Hi, Jason.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So it's a great pleasure. So Jason is the former White House envoy to the Middle East, where he served as assistant to the president and special representative for international negotiations. He played a key role in developing the Abraham Accords, signed in 2020, that saw Israel normalize its relations with the UAE, Bahrain, and Morocco. Today, Jason is the director of Arab-Israel Diplomacy for the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. And additionally, Jason is the author of a book, In the Path of Abraham, which provides an insider's perspective on how the Abraham Accords were concluded, a book which we highly recommend. He can be found on his social media channels on X at GreenblattJD, that's Greenblatt with two T's, and on Instagram at Jason.Greenblatt, so you can follow him there. Jason is, as you can hear, an expert on the global geopolitical dynamics of the Gulf and the wider Middle East, and its impact on trade and business-to-business relations, and it's in that context that we wanted to speak to him today. Jason, it really is a great honor and a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here at this very challenging time for everybody.
It is indeed. It is indeed. So where we are today, and when we're recording here on the 4th of December, we've seen this week the ceasefire with Hamas end, between Israel and Hamas end, the ceasefire which saw the return of over 100 hostages, and sadly, there still remain some 125, including women and children, in the dungeons under Gaza. And as Hamas broke the ceasefire, fighting has now renewed. From a U.S. perspective, what do you think is the long-term appetite of both the Biden administration and the Congress to continue its so far very strong political and financial support of Israel during this latest crisis?
We're at a very sensitive time at the moment. Look, it's funny because I worked in the Trump administration. I'm associated with President Trump, proudly so. By the way, I had my criticism of President Biden until October 7th, significant criticism of how he had policy in the Middle East. But since October 7th and until just about last week, I suppose, I think he's done a great job. I think he's stood by Israel. I think Congress has stood by Israel in a very, very strong way. And throughout the administration, spokespeople, national security advisor, the president himself. I think, unfortunately, where we are now is it's unclear where President Biden is going to go at this point. He's facing a lot of political pressure. Good for him that he stood up to the political pressure. I hope he continues to stand up. But there are a lot of people who are saying, look, get the hostages out, put the guns down, and let's figure out a solution. And what people don't realize is there is no solution for Israel unless and until Hamas is uprooted, unless and until there's new leadership in what I call Judea and Samaria. Perhaps some of your audience might use the West Bank. Nobody should ever use this term, occupied Palestinian territory. That's an erroneous, completely incorrect designation for Judea and Samaria. But the Biden administration is definitely facing tremendous pressure. I think they realize deep down they have to stand with Israel. I think they realize deep down that the goal of Israel to eliminate Hamas, if it could be achieved, is the right goal, not only for Israel, but for Israel's neighbors. But I'm not sure they're going to be able to withstand the pressure, not just politically in the United States, but for many countries around the world, to figure out a solution to stop Israel from continuing its quest to destroy Hamas.
Right. So you mentioned the political pressure. A lot of that we're seeing on college campuses, or the roots of it on college campuses, and in the street with you know, major demonstrations in the U.S. and globally. Do you think that that's having a significant impact on broader public opinion? And, you know, is it having impact on those who are making some of the sort of core decisions, including financial decisions around things like divestment?
So my answer is going to be just what's in my heart, in my head. I have no data to support it. I actually think the crazy protests that we're seeing on college campuses in the street is having the opposite effect on what these people want. They're going in, they're disrupting roadways, they're disrupting stores, they're disrupting life. They're so violent and threatening that I think many people who ordinarily wouldn't support Israel, who would be a little bit more careful in terms of how they support Israel, are actually taking a step back and saying, wait a second, this is not America. I don't want my kids walking on the street this way. I'm afraid for my kids. So clearly they have a tremendous amount of support on the extreme where they are. And, you know, they're having a great time at it, disrupting everything, threatening everything, making people feel unsafe and insecure, and fomenting their hatred of Jews, their hatred of Israel. But I think in terms of the wider population and in terms of Congress and the administration, I think people are looking at this and saying, what's happening to America? And they don't stand by it. And I think they're very worried about it.
Hmm. If that analysis proves correct, that for the long term, or even for the medium term of the relationship between Israel and the US is a big positive.
Well, so here I'm going to actually say the opposite.
Yeah,
I'll tell you why I'm concerned. There, it's no secret that the Democrat Party has a left-wing flank that is anti-Israel. And I'm not particularly worried that it's going to grow in the next year or three, but it is growing. And the people that we see on college campuses shouting these hateful slogans, from the river to the sea, Intifada, revolution, globalize the Intifada, all these hateful Jew hatred, anti-Israel comments. Unfortunately, a lot of this is happening in very prestigious universities. And there are many people within those protests who will eventually grow up to become members of Congress, maybe work in the White House like I was privileged to do. And I do worry that if we don't tackle that problem, I don't mean tackle the problem by trying to educate the crazy haters, those right. that are really at the center of the vortex of instigating the hate. But I do think that those around those people are instigating the hate. Those who probably don't even understand which river and which sea when they talk about from the river to the sea. Those who have been fed a pile of lies about Israel, about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, they will eventually become part of the U.S. government. And that's where I fear. When they grow up and become adults, if we don't educate them between now and then I do think we have a very, very big problem on our hands.
Interesting. Okay. In your book, In the Path of Abraham, you write how the Abraham Accords have the potential to usher in really a new era of peace and prosperity. They were designed to pay dividends, both at the wider people-to-people level, at the business-to-business level. And that, I suppose, in contrast to the sort of cold government-to-government peace that was the outcome of the Camp David Accords, the peace between Israel and Egypt, and to a certain extent, the peace between Israel and Jordan. Given the current crisis, do you believe that the Abraham Accords is still capable of fulfilling that potential?
Yes, I absolutely do. Look, this war will be over. It's not going to be over in a few weeks, but it will be over. And I think after the war is over, the Abraham Accords will continue to go strong. I don't think the Abraham Accords have been derailed. I do think the Abraham Accords countries and Israel are right now sort of in this delicate balance of how do we continue the amazing, important, serious, sensitive Abraham Accords relationships. But I think they're doing it a little bit more slowly, a little bit more on the side. But I think that's going to come burst into full bloom again once this war is over. And I'll take it a step further. I do think countries like Saudi Arabia, at some point, whether it's under President Biden now in the White House, whoever the occupant is going to be in the Oval Office after the next election, I think they're all going to get together again and try to figure out how do we enhance and expand the Abraham Accords. Because one thing is for sure, the region completely understands the importance of the Abraham Accords. The region understands the importance of integrating Israel into the region. The region really knows who the enemy is. The enemy is Hamas. The enemy are the Houthis. The enemy is Hezbollah. The enemy is really the Iranian regime. And And I think that these countries know that. They have these grand visions that they're already executing on in such an amazing way. Mm-hmm. And they understand that unless there's stability in the region, they can't give over to the next generation. And there are so many of the next generation in these countries. They have a tremendous youth bulge. They cannot give over to the next generation what they're promising to give unless there's stability. And Israel is part of stability, and Hamas is not just part of instability. Hamas is part of undermining and destroying everything that they want to build.
Right. So if you bring it down to what we would expect next year, you know, the war comes to a close. Hopefully we all pray that the IDF is successful in uprooting Hamas and destroying its military infrastructure and its political infrastructure. Do you see the relationships, the trade, the business, the interpersonal contacts that were being fostered, you know, up to October 7th, do you see them coming back quickly? Or is it going to take time as we sort of rev up the engine again?
I wouldn't say it's going to happen overnight, because I think both sides are going to have to sort of redevelop the trust is the wrong word, but redevelop the comfort with one another.
Yeah.
But I don't think it'll take terribly long. I think both sides have a lot to gain. I think both sides realize that. And I think both sides are eager to continue those contacts. By the way, they're still eager now, but there's a lot of hesitation. People just feel a tremendous amount of discomfort. There are certainly some on the fringes of all societies that are upset with both sides, you know, depending on which side you're standing on. But I do think that it will come back, and it'll come back with a fair degree of ease.
Right. You mentioned before Saudi Arabia. We were all watching very closely in the months leading up to 7th of October, as the expectation was building of what seemed at the time to be an imminent or close by a deal between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Is that deal dead for now?
No, I wouldn't call it dead. I wouldn't even say it's on ice, but I would say it's sort of in reserve. First of all, even before the atrocities of October 7, President Biden, who I want to commend for finally picking up the Abraham Accords and trying to expand it, had a tall order, right? Saudi Arabia was asking for a lot of things. By the way, very important. I don't begrudge His Royal Highness the Crown Prince for asking for those things. He's right to ask for them. He's right to ask for a mutual defense treaty, because that makes sense for Saudi Arabia. Maybe it makes sense for the United States too. That'll be up to Congress. He's right to ask for a civil nuclear power for Saudi Arabia, whether it makes sense for Israel to agree for that to happen, whether it makes sense for the United States to agree for that to happen, we'll see. He was right to ask for more, however more is defined, for the Palestinians, which, by the way, I think that's going to be even more when those discussions come up again. But he was also right, and if your viewers didn't watch his interview on Fox News with Bret Baier, I would say they should watch his interview on Fox News. It was in English, and how he couched the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, how he spoke about what he wants for Palestinians, is very different than it used to be said. He stands by the Palestinians. Saudi Arabia and most of the Arab countries stand by the Palestinians. But as the Abraham Accords showed, they also recognize that they have their own national agenda. That national agenda is economic. The national agenda is security and so many other things. And they realized they cannot let the Palestinians stymie their efforts. They can't let those Palestinians become veto cards on their own future. So I think that when the war is over, they will go back to these discussions. They will overcome those hurdles. And I think they will continue to pursue it. I don't think it'll happen on the day after, but part of it may get delayed, because we were going into a pretty, exciting, contentious, riveting election cycle, right? And that's going to suck up a lot of the oxygen in the room. So whether the Biden administration will have the bandwidth to do this during an election cycle, we'll see. But whether it's before a new president is elected, after a president is elected, I think someone is going to pick that up, including Saudi Arabia, because they do want it. If a deal can come to fruition, that makes sense for them.
Yeah. Of course, there are going to be post-war politicking here in Israel as well, which also is going to have an impact, one would expect. When you look at the Arab Street and its reaction to the war, you know, and being fed by Al Jazeera, and you know the what they see on you know in the media. And then you then contrast that with the reaction of leadership of the UAE and Bahrain, and you know their statements calling for a continuation of the Abraham Accords, and really a very supportive statement. You know, how did those two pieces fit together in this new Middle East that we're sort of trying to figure out?
So sometimes the Middle East is like this giant puzzle on the table, and the pieces don't always fit together, and you're looking around constantly for where those crucial pieces went. Did the dog eat them? Did they fall on the floor? Were they not in the box, right?
Right.
First of all, I also think that the UAE and Bahrain, as you mentioned, should be commended for standing by the Abraham Accords in a very, very strong way. I think their populations largely support the Abraham Accords because they believe in their leaders. Bahrain certainly has a challenge. There's a certain portion of its population that do not. But they believe in their leaders. They believe in the future presented by their leaders. And I think that's why you see them continuing to push the Abraham Accords. Very different from Jordan and even Egypt. And those two are very different populations as well. In Jordan, you have some say 50, some say as high as 70% of the population is Palestinian. So the King of Jordan has his hands full trying to deal with that. And I have no optimism that anytime soon the, let's call it security peace or cold peace, as it's said, is going to change. And I think that's unfortunate for Jordan. I don't think it matters terribly for Israel. It would be great if it were different. But I think Jordan stands much more to gain from a warmer peace with Israel than the reverse. Egypt is not the same. They clearly stand by the Palestinians in a big way, but they also recognize the importance of Israel as a partner, as a strategic partner. Israel, of course, recognizes the same in Egypt. But I'm also not so optimistic that how they approach the peace treaty will change dramatically anytime soon. But I do think that the Abraham Accords countries, and even after, even those who don't yet sign the Abraham Accords, will be able to sort of find their way to have relationships with Israel, both from an economic perspective, perhaps a tourism perspective, perhaps a cultural perspective. I think they'll find their way, even in the absence of a full-blown Abraham Accords, they'll find their way together. As we saw over the past many months, before October 7, Saudi Arabia had opened its airspace to Israel. Saudi Arabia had welcomed more than one minister from Israel into Saudi Arabia. There were so many things that, when I was in the White House, seemed, I'll say, small, right? Having Israeli journalists invited to some of these countries. They were big then, but in the scope of the Abraham Accords, they actually seemed small. They remain big, actually. The fact that the World Expo had Israel presenting, yes, that was after the Abraham Accords, but I'll tell you that the discussions and the agreement to have Israel present at the World Expo happened way before the Abraham Accords were really ever contemplated formally. So all of these things mean something. Having Israeli athletes at these countries that are not signers means something. Having the Israeli national anthem, the Hatikva, means something. And I think we will go back to that and then hopefully eventually build on it and see more successes down the road.
Right. I want to pick up one of those pieces that fell on the floor or maybe was chewed up by the dog. And that's Qatar or Qatar. I never quite know which is the right pronunciation. So you know, this is a country that sends huge amounts of money to Hamas. And yet the US has, you know, a relationship, has a lot of leverage there. Why hasn't the Biden administration, the United States, used that leverage, both political and military, to pressure Qatar into changing its attitude to Hamas? And, you know, they currently host the leadership of Hamas on top of the money. Why is that piece still laying on the floor?
Or chewed up by the dog.
Or chewed up by the dog.
So I want to talk about the pressure, and then I'll address the Qatar angle. If people think that the United States, the most powerful, most important country in the world, can do, you know, has this ability to put pressure on different countries. And there are times that we do. We don't have as much pressure and power as we think with many countries in the Middle East. We just don't. And that's further exacerbated by the no longer a unipolar world that we live in. We have China, we have Russia, we have other actors on the world stage, and what used to be potentially the power that the United States has been watered down. I also think the Biden administration, and here I'll be a little bit critical of the Biden administration, I think they've watered down that power even more. They weren't the cause of the watering down the power, but they're not appearing incredibly strong on a general basis, having nothing to do with their response to October 7th. And I think that has an impact. Now I'll talk about Qatar itself. And I take a different view than many on Qatar. First of all, Qatar's funding of Gaza, I'll speak only from 2017 and on. I can't speak to before 2017. 2017 is when I worked at the White House and beyond. So I know what happened then. I can't speak to what happened before me. The money that Qatar funded to Gaza was done at the request of and in full coordination with the Israelis. So we could speak about how, whether it was smart policy or not smart policy, we could speak about whether that policy should be changed going forward. But I think it's a bit unfair to criticize Qatar for a policy that was set in motion by Israel, by Qatar, and probably even by the United States. As far as I know, that policy didn't change under the Biden administration. So from 2017 until October 7, Qatar was acting in concert with Israel and with the United States. As far as hosting Hamas leaders, my answer is similar. Qatar's view had been, if we can not so much control them, but influence them, have these guys here instead of having them live perhaps in Iran, Gaza, Turkey, or elsewhere, maybe there's a way that they could influence them in a positive direction. And again, we can now debate, was that a good policy, a bad policy? Should that policy change moving forward? Those are all extremely fair, appropriate discussions to have. But I do think we had seen until at least Friday, last Friday, that relationship with Hamas paying off, and that's how the hostages were released.
Yep.
And I'd hesitate to tell anybody to, you know, any hostage loving, you know, loved family member to say, no, we shouldn't have had Hamas there, and your loved one should have languished in the horrific conditions. So yes. I think how they've been acting has been actually extremely helpful. Now, that deal has fallen apart for the moment. I hope Qatar can pick up those puzzle pieces to get more hostages out. I also hope Qatar will not stand in the way of Israel trying to destroy Hamas. I do believe it's in Qatar's best interest as well. I don't think they would say that. I'm not sure if they believe it or not. But I think Qatar has played a very positive and useful role now. And whether the policy was mistaken or not, well, they're not the only ones who had that policy in place. And I hope they'll engage in good faith dialogue with Israel, with the United States, to see how that policy should change in the future.
Yeah, hindsight is always 20/20, as they say. I want to just touch on one other element of this war that we're now in. I think a lot of Israelis turned around a few weeks ago and said, the Houthis? Who are the Houthis? And why are they lobbing missiles at Eilat? And you know, why are they firing rockets at commercial ships in the Red Sea, thinking that they're Israeli? They are, we're learning under the great control of Iran, and we're seeing a serious escalation in a part of the region which until now is not one that Israel has really had to focus on. That is not only a direct threat to Israel because of the shipping lanes that pass by that part of the world, but it's also proposing a threat to international shipping more generally. So what is the US doing about this, and should they be more active, should the administration be more active in confronting Iran and the support it's given to the Houthis as this is becoming an increasingly greater problem?
Three words and then I'll go longer. Not enough and yes. Not enough at all. The US administration is not doing enough. Yes, they need to do more. Number of years ago, I would say that I was probably one of the, I can't say the only person on the planet, but perhaps one of the few people on the planet who had both experienced missile fire from two Iranian terror proxies. Hamas, I was in the Azrieli Towers about to have dinner, and Hamas was, as they often did, raining missiles, this time on Tel Aviv, and I had to take shelter. And not much long after that, I was on the runway in Riyadh with my son. We were about to take off for Jeddah. We had to deplane because the Houthis were firing missiles at Saudi Arabia. And I pointed out to everybody then that the Houthis are like Hamas, the Houthis are for the UAE and for Saudi Arabia, like Hamas is for Israel. They are all arms of the octopus head, the Iranian regime. They all want to destroy, well, Iran has made no secret, the Iranian regime has made no secret, they want to destroy Israel, but they also want to take over all those beautiful cities in the Gulf that have been built and that are being built. And I think the US, in particular the Biden administration, is, I don't want to say missing it. I'm sure deep down they get it, but they're extremely weak in confronting Iran. And I'm not sure there is a good answer. I'm not saying the US should now engage militarily with the Iranian regime more than what they're doing, or at least significantly more than what they're doing. I'm not advocating for Israel to do it at the moment. I'm not a military person, so I can't give that advice. But the fact that the US, the Biden administration, is unwilling to say out loud that it is the Iranian regime that was the cause of October 7, whether they knew about the plans, specific plans in advance, the date of the event, the time of the event, we'll see. We'll see what happens when these investigations unfold, right? But the fact that they don't say out loud that without the backing, the funding, the training, the support, emotional and otherwise, of their terror proxy murderous thugs, none of this would happen. And I think they need to be stronger. I think that we've now been attacked multiple times over the last number of weeks since October 7. Our responses have been fairly muted. And I think we need to stand up and say, hey, Iranian regime, enough's enough. We're going to take care of you. One way or the other, we're going to take care of you. Don't mess with us. Don't mess with our friends and allies, not Israel, not the UAE, not Saudi Arabia, not anybody. And I don't think they're doing enough on that.
Right. Well, once again, Israel, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, are very much in the same boat and very much dealing with the same challenges and problems. And the U.S. Is certainly behind there, you know, giving a strong backing, which obviously we really couldn't be doing what we're doing now in Gaza without the United States. So Jason Greenblatt, thank you very, very much for being on Definitely Uncertain. It's been hugely insightful, and I really appreciate the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for those who want to pick up Jason's book, In the Path of Abraham, I'm sure you can get it. I'd say you can get it in bookstores. I don't think there are any bookstores anymore, but I'm sure you can get it on Amazon. And if you are looking for more episodes of Definitely Uncertain, you can find it on YouTube and wherever you download your podcast. And there'll be more episodes coming your way soon. Thanks, everybody.